Well, you're all very, very welcome to doing justice to the dead. And this is one of our Centre for the Study of Human Rights public lectures. My name is Conor Gearty. I'm the director of the centre. I want to welcome you all. And we have, we're beginning a theme about slavery and the whole question of enslavement, which we may well return to this in the course of the next few years. And there is an exhibition which is in the atrium there, the Student Services Centre, which highlights the library resources of the organisation Anti-Slavery International. So it might be worth looking at that. I think it's not accessible this evening because it's a careers fair, but it can be visited any time just passing through the Student Services. There's a nice cabinet. Now, what we're going to do is I'm going to introduce the speakers, and we have three. We had a fourth, an additional speaker who was a woman, and I'm afraid she's not here. So we have, for the first time in my tenure as director of the Centre for the Study of Human Rights, we have an all-male cast. And I am sorry about that. I am deeply apologetic. But that is not because I didn't want any of our speakers to come. It's because our fourth speaker was unable to come. So please forgive us this, but we have noticed. Okay, so thank you very much. Exactly. So that's enough heckling of the chair by the speakers. We have our first speaker is John Torpy. I was going to say that he had 15 minutes. He has, in fact, got 5 minutes. He's used up 10 minutes by assaulting the chair. John is, we're delighted to have John. He's here. He's come over especially for this. He's told me this afternoon. He works in Canada, actually, now, the University of British Columbia, associate professor of sociology. He was particularly interested in the question of how the past has come to play such a prominent role in contemporary politics. He's involved as an associate director in a new center there at UBC on the study of historical consciousness. He's edited a book, Politics and the Past, on repairing historical injustices, and he's very interested in the whole issue of the history of modern social thought. So John is going to kick us off with 15 minutes on the subject from his particular perspective. We're then delighted to have, I was saying to him on the way over, the Alex Ferguson of the NGO sector. He's been deputy director of Anti-Slavery International's. He's been working for them since 1991, and he's responsible at the moment for the control of Anti-Slavery International finances. That is David Old, who's the next gentleman over. Very closely involved with UK and international campaigning on issues of the commercial exploitation of children, the use of bonded child labour. He's also worked as a scholar in the field, contributed a chapter on trafficking and international law to a book on the political economy of new slavery, published in 2004. So David will have some remarks about the contemporary scene as well as the past. And then wrapping it up is a great friend of mine. I'm delighted to see him here at the centre, a barrister, Lincoln Crawford, member of the Home Office's Race Equality Advisory Panel. Lincoln does so many things apart from practice. Tribunal chairman at the Employment People, recorder. But for today, worth noticing, also chairman of the Slavery Working Party and really very concerned with the issue of slavery and how to address historical injustices. So we have really got, despite our woman not being here, we have an all-star cast, I think. Each is going to speak for 15 minutes. Then we get in true Centre for the Study of Human Rights we get a chance to put our own questions, our own comments, and then in even truer Centre for the Study of Human Rights tradition, we all adjourn for a drink. But as you know, those of you regular attenders of the events here, I don't tell you where the drink is until the event is over. So you've that to look forward to. I announce the location at the end. And the end is between 20 and 25 past 7. So don't feel that you're trapped here all night. Although you might want to be. Our first speaker then is John Torpy.
Thank you, Connor. I always think it's a difficult position to be in, to stand between a bunch of people and cocktails, but I hope you'll indulge me in any case. I want to thank Connor and the Center for the Study of Human Rights, and especially Claire Moon and Joy White for making possible my participation in this event. Our subject is doing justice to the dead, a version of the broader problem of coming to terms with the past, or what in German is called Geschichtsbewältigung, mastering the past. This issue has grown increasingly significant on the political and scholarly agenda in recent years. Indeed, a few years ago, the Nobel Prize-winning Nigerian author Wole Soyinka suggested that we were in the midst of what he called a fin de millénaire fever of atonement. This phenomenon, I think, has ridden on the back of the growing significance of the Holocaust in Western cultural self-understanding. The Holocaust, in turn, has served as a kind of template or model for a variety of campaigns around the world to come to terms with the past, the kind of standard phrase here. Another important part of the background has been the process of decolonization, which has had both external and internal dimensions. That is, white settler colonial regimes generally withdrew as their rule was delegitimized in the post-World War II period. Similarly, those groups that could be seen as internally colonized had a stronger basis for challenging the rule of white settlers over them. In the process, there arose a new understanding of the notion of indigenous peoples, now meaning not those who reside in a country or place, or not merely that, but referring rather to the descendants of those once colonized mainly by Europeans. More generally, I think identity politics and the so-called politics of recognition came to compete with, and in some degree perhaps to supplant, the so-called politics of redistribution. In the U.S., at least, this process was also fueled by what the sociologist John Screntney has called the minority rights revolution and its emphasis on certain designated minorities as disadvantaged. At a much more general level, I think the success of Freudianism helped to promote the notion of the importance of the past in shaping the present, that is, Freud and psychoanalysis's emphasis on the way in which past experiences tend to govern our contemporary behavior. So therapeutic sensibilities, I think, also play an important role in these developments as well. All of this contributed, I think, to a substantial reorientation of at least some parts of progressive thinking, which by definition had always focused on the future. Now it almost seemed as though the old labor movement slogan, "Don't mourn, organize," was reversed, so to read, "organize to mourn." To put it another way, there's been a shift from Voltaire's dictum, "to the living we owe respect, to the dead we owe only the truth," to Faulkner's claim that the past is not over, it's not even past. Now, Faulkner's remark raises the obvious problem that it's not always possible to delineate the present from the past. When the German philosopher Max Horkheimer wrote in a letter to his friend and colleague Walter Benjamin that past injustice is over and done with, the slain are truly slain, he thought he could make that distinction clearly. But in some cases, past injustice seems to continue into the present. Moreover, some groups, or more precisely certain members of some groups, refuse to kick the dirt over past injustice. Indeed, they regard the lack of attention to past injustice as a continuation or even a repetition of that past injustice. Demands by certain collectivities for the rectification of past wrong raises the question of the modes whereby this can be achieved, if at all. In other words, whether Horkheimer isn't really right that not much can be done about past injustice. And one increasingly important mode that I've focused most of my scholarly attention on in recent years is associated with this notion of reparations. But it's important to note, first of all, I think, that the meaning of that term has undergone a dramatic transformation in the post-World War II period. Before World War II, the term referred exclusively to war reparations. In some sense, it was redundant to add that qualifier, war reparations. In other words, it was a fine among states. The winners of the war said that the losers had caused it and were going to pay the costs for starting the whole mess. Versailles is here the paradigmatic case. And of course, this meaning still exists. I don't mean to suggest that it doesn't exist anymore. But in recent years, I think in significant part due to the saliency of reparations for the Holocaust and related crimes of the Nazis, the term has been appropriated by many groups seeking redress for historical wrongs. A good example is the South African group called the South African Reparations Movement, which defines the term as the compensation owed by the former oppressor to the oppressed for the wrongs that were done to them. Now, this approach or this way of thinking about this, I think, works better in some cases than in others. The notion of reparations for blacks in the United States, for example, tends to generate antipathy among whites, in part because it suggests the idea of sort of individual checks to blacks, which is not necessarily, in fact, the goal of many reparations activists. There's division kind of in this community over what exactly they're aiming for, but often it has much more to do with what South Africans, for example, would understand as kind of economic empowerment, small business loans, educational loans, and the like. Moreover, there's division among reparations activists in this U.S. case over whether the claim is for slavery, in other words, whether the compensation being sought or the wrong in question was slavery, where there's nobody alive who actually lived through slavery, or whether it's in fact for Jim Crow segregation laws and their consequences, much of which has to do with the gap in wealth between whites and blacks, which had a great deal to do with the fact that blacks were, until 1948, precluded by these so-called restrictive covenants from buying many properties. And as it happens, apropos the terminology, in turn, Japanese Americans who began to struggle for some kind of compensation in the 70s, but especially in the 80s, were advised by influential figures to use the term redress rather than reparations, because the latter was seen as kind of too scary on the one hand, and the notion of redress was said to be something to which Americans had a right, whereas reparations was not something to which they had a right. Now, the notion of reparations, in turn, I think, has increasingly come to mean something different from reparation, kind of the singular. In essence, now one pays reparations, but one makes reparation. That is, reparation can come in a variety of different forms, both material and symbolic. And these might include, aside from, you know, economic compensation of some sort, memorializing certain events, truth commissions to clarify what exactly happened and try to create a kind of official statement of what happened, clearing one's name if one's been wrongfully arrested, and that sort of thing. And these kinds of provisions have now become really part of international law as a result of the United Nations so-called Basic Guidelines on the Right to Reparation for Victims of Gross Violations of Human Rights, sometimes known as the Bassiouni Principles, or by reference to their originator, really, the Van Boven Principles. Theo van Boven, a name that may be familiar to many of you, started out working on this set of issues, but is now head of the UN Commission on Torture, the body that deals with torture. That is, it's come to be more or less a norm that persons wronged who are still alive have a right to some sort of compensation and redress. Now, whether they get it or not, it's a different story. But in theory, this has, I think, now become a norm, a part of customary international law. But the cases of those who are no longer alive, who have been wronged and are no longer alive, tend to be much more difficult, because one part of the problem here is that attempts to get compensation or redress of some sort for wrongs from the past, from which there are no survivors today, have this tendency to reassert the boundaries, usually racial or ethnic, on the basis of which the original injustices were perpetrated. So in other words, a whole class of people is said to be, you know, the likely beneficiary of some set of compensatory acts. And of course, this raises difficulties in the case of, for example, in the case of reparations for blacks in the United States. The question you tend to get is, well, you know, do Oprah Winfrey and Michael Jordan also get reparations if blacks get reparations? even affirmative action programs that target underrepresented or disadvantaged minorities while being, in a certain sense, more future-oriented, are often criticized for helping those members of these groups who are already relatively advantaged. That is to say, they don't seem to do a very good job of helping the poorest of the poor. And this criticism or argument, in turn, tends to elicit the suggestion that people of any ethnic background should be assisted on the basis of their class position. In other words, the response is to say, well, let's help everybody who is badly off in some particular sense, but basically in a class or income sense, irrespective of their ethnic or racial identity. This is, however, sometimes rejected because it fails to address what is said to be the kind of super oppression or super exploitation of certain groups based on their ethnicity or race historically. Now, I don't want to overstay my welcome because I've been told this is severely sanctioned here. So I do want to say a few words, though, about sort of thinking about the past as opposed to the present, which I think is a significant issue in these discussions. I hinted earlier at this business about a kind of competition, perhaps, between coming to terms with the past on the one hand and fixing the present on the other. And I have to confess that I tend to worry that sometimes more attention is paid to the past than is entirely desirable. Obviously, people who wish redress and assistance in order to deal with past wrongs should be helped. But when I think of the campaign, for example, to have the Turkish government declare that the Armenian massacres of 1915 were a genocide, it seems to me that that there's a considerable irony here. I mean, Raphael Lemkin created the term, the neologism, genocide, during World War II, with the aim of, and of course the objective of the Genocide Convention embodies this, hope that the Genocide Convention or the notion will be used to forestall or to put an end to a genocide that is now in progress. So the preoccupation with having a set of events declared a genocide that took place 90 years ago, I mean, obviously this would make some people feel better, and there's a certain sense in which Turkish society, I think, would be much better off in airing this discussion more openly, to which it has been profoundly resistant. But at the same time, in the face of events in Darfur, Northern Uganda, Congo, and elsewhere, one, I think, has to wonder about whether this is the best thing that one could do with one's time and efforts. It might be a more fitting tribute to the dead to try to forestall a repetition of their fate. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, John. Next we have David. David Orr.
Thank you very much. I often feel I'm sent out by my organisation to talk at events like this because I'm perhaps the only person who still in the organisation looks as though they might have been a British abolitionist at the end of the 18th century. excuse my beard. Anti-Slavery International, we were founded in 1839. We always say we're the world's oldest international human rights organisation, and I haven't yet found anybody to challenge it, so I assume we're probably right. And we were formed by a lot of the radicals, particularly the radicals who'd been working to end the slave trade and the use of slavery in the British Empire. And what they basically said was, as people did at that time, what about the rest of the world? And since then, that's what we've been working on, but coming back to the UK, and I'll revert to that as we move on. What I want to talk about and try and do some linkage is slavery. Does it really still exist? Are we talking about the same thing? And I think there was something very interesting that was said earlier on. There's nobody alive who lived through slavery. There may be nobody alive who lived through the transatlantic slave trade, but I would certainly argue that there are lots of people alive who lived through slavery. I want to look a bit about what types of slavery we work against, where in the world we're working, and at the end of it, a little bit about what can be done. We've got two commemorations floating around at the moment. 2004 is called the UN International Year to commemorate the struggle against slavery and its abolition. And 2007 will be very much in the mind of the UK, and we've already heard from the government that they intend to do a lot on it, is the 200th anniversary of the abolition of UK shipping involvement in the slave trade. So we still had slaves, we still had slaves in the British Empire, but ships could no longer carry them and make money out of them. Recently, there's been some interesting discussions at the United Nations about slavery, and it is quite difficult sometimes to get the UN and other bodies to pick up slavery at a senior level. Lots of what I would call middle-ranking parts of the Commission for Human Rights will talk about slavery, but to get it spoken about at high levels is more difficult. But both Kofi Annan and Koichiro Matsuura have called for international recognition that in new and changing forms, slavery and trafficking remain serious abuses of human rights that need wider recognition and action by the international community. And I think that's very much what we would agree with. That's very much what we're looking to do. The transatlantic slave trade and slavery within the British Empire was ended by a collaboration, and it was a collaboration of information about slavery and its realities that came from slaves who broke away, who ran away, who stood up for their rights, who tried desperately to get other people out of slavery, and that sort of, shall we call it, liberal consensus, moral rectitude that was floating around in the UK at the time, that were willing to lobby on their behalf to really put pressure on the government. And it took an awful long time. We always forget this. It took something like 60 years of hard campaigning at both ends of the scale. And what Anti-Slavery International is trying to do today is almost exactly the same. Here we are, we sit in London, we don't have offices all around the world, but what we do have are partnerships with lots of local organisations, lots of local people working in their own countries, in their own backyards. Many of them are people who have already escaped from slavery, who were brought up in slavery conditions or around people in slavery and want to do something to end it, and will seek support from wherever they can get it, and quite rightly so. What we're trying, of course, to do is to get action. Action by you, action by all sorts of people, but particularly action by governments and international governmental agencies. Years ago, we probably would have said, send a gunboat. These days, we try and look for slightly more carefully thought-out answers, shall we call them. But what is slavery? Well, that's the United Nations definition, the status or condition of a person over whom any or all of the powers attaching to the rights of ownership are exercised. And I think there's an interesting bit about that. To my mind, the crucial area, certainly in terms of contemporary slavery, is this question of any or all, any of the powers attaching to the rights of ownership. And to try and put that into perspective, one of the areas that we do quite a lot of work on are issues of migrant workers and particularly migrant domestic workers, and this is an issue all around the world. And one way that control is exercised over domestic workers is by taking away their passports, taking away their documents, and certainly literally taking these things away from them. And I would certainly argue that what this is doing is exercising some form of partial ownership over those people, because you're taking away their rights to leave. You're taking away that ability to exercise control over your own lives, over your own where you work, And of course, many of these people are migrant workers. They don't know what the rules are. They don't know who they might turn to, and they can be very frightened. And it is a very good and I'm afraid effective method of exercising control. I might add that the British government has recently announced, and I do mean recently, about last week, that they intend to criminalise the taking away of somebody else's passport, which does at least show that lobbying after a while does have an effect, but it's taken something like 7 years to get that through. But modern slavery, contemporary slavery, how do we try and define it as wider than just simple partial or total ownership? What does it actually mean in reality today? The area that we work to most is something called the United Nations Supplementary Convention on Slavery and Slavery-like Practices. And that talks about five types of slavery. Traditional slavery, that is the ownership. Bonded labor. Bonded labor is where people agree to take a loan and in return they will work for that person to pay off the loan. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. The trick comes when the only person who decides how much work you might do, what work you might do, when you might do it, is the person who lent you the money. And the reasons that you take the money are many, various, and almost always forced. And it is a wonderful way of retaining labor for when you need it. Historically, it's a very old form of slavery. It was, you'll find it both in the Old Testament and the Quran, both talk about bonded labor, and they both say that you should release your bonded laborers after a short period of time. I think it's 4 and 5 years, but don't quote me. The point is that historically, and the way it worked was very much in agricultural communities, very often people were protected from the worst excesses of it by those communities. Everybody knew what the problems were. What's happening in modern life is that it is being used as another way of finding cheap and servile forms of labor again when you need it. Numbers, probably millions, probably tens of millions, mainly in South Asia, but you do get it elsewhere. So for instance, some women are being trafficked into the UK today who will have borrowed money in order to get them here, and they are told they need to work to pay off that loan, but again, the amount of work and how the loan is paid off is not something that's in their control. Serfdom. The most traditional, most of us were probably descended from serfs. You belonged not so much to a person, but to the area where you worked, the land that you worked on. It's still banned. It's pretty uncommon as a standard form of slavery, and nearly always these days it would be related to bonded labor. Different, I think, is the issue of servile forms of marriage. Women bought or sold into marriage without the right to refuse. A difficult area. We do some work on it, but again, the bearded gentleman in London syndrome becomes quite difficult here. We work with local partners, and the crucial issue, as far as we're concerned in this, is what the alternatives that you can offer are. What the alternatives, if you say to women they do have the right to refuse marriage, if they're then exiled from the village, if they're then exiled from their whole community, you clearly have to be able to offer them something as an alternative before you can tell them that they're free to make those choices and to give them those choices. You might like to think about that. It's quite a difficult area in terms of how you work on these sorts of issues. Giving or selling children into exploitation. So if you work at home, however much your parents make you work, it's not slavery. It might be exploitative, but it ain't slavery. If you're given or sold to somebody else to exploit you as a child, then it can be slavery. It's certainly the most high-profile area that we work on because everybody is concerned about children. But don't get me wrong, it is serious. It affects hundreds of thousands, probably millions of children. And an area that is fairly uncommonly talked about, but that we've done a lot of work on, are children who are bought, sold, and increasingly we talk today about trafficked into domestic work. So these are children who are sent away from home to work in domestic service for somebody else. They are very abused, or many of them can be. Some of them are very well looked after, brought up, and actually do better out of it. Previously, 3 years ago, we had a program officer in Anti-Slavery International who came from Burkina Faso. She had actually been sent away from home to work as a domestic servant for a relative in Burkina Faso, and as a result got much better education than she would have done in the village, went to university, and gained very much out of it. So this is a system, if it's used properly, can work very well. But when it's abused, and it is abused, means that 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds are working 12, 13, 14 hours a day, no schooling, no nothing, and nobody to turn to. Increasingly, these are not within a village. These are people who are sent from villages to towns, even to other countries, and that's where the problems come. How do you see where they are? How do you look after them? How do you offer them any opportunities? Historical slavery and contemporary slavery, are they linked at all? I think the answer to that is definitely yes. And transatlantic slave trade and all that went with it was definitely one of the most terrible issues of European history. There's no doubt about that. And it was a tragedy for Africa, and that tragedy continues today. What we would increasingly see is that the issues that forced people into slavery or allowed people to keep slaves are similar today than they were that long ago, 200 years ago. And it's to do with racism, it's to do with discrimination. They were clearly at the heart of the slave trade. And I think I can argue that in lots of areas that we're working today, they're at the heart of what we're talking about. trafficking of migrant workers to the UK. You probably all saw the issue of Chinese cockle pickers and how they were being talked about, treated by gangmasters. Now, I'm not sure whether most or any of those people were slavery, but it is certainly true that many Chinese migrant workers in the UK are bonded. Now, that straightforward bonding to other Chinese people who send them abroad from China. But the problem in the UK is that we do not do very much about it. And why do we not do very much about it? Because there are other people from other countries over there. If people, workers from this country, were treated that way, the law would clamp down very quickly, because they're migrant workers, because potentially they're illegal migrant workers. We do much less. Bonded labourers in South Asia, I talked about bonded labourers. The thing that I didn't mention was that almost 100% of them are from the Dalit community, or from the Adivasi, the tribal peoples, or from other forms of minority elements. And the reason, of course, they're held in bonded labour, and the reason, when there are perfectly good laws in all these countries that ban bonded labour, that nothing is done about it, is because they are at the bottom of the caste heap, the bottom of people who are discriminated against. Sudan. Darfur has already been mentioned, but Sudan, for the last, since 1978, has had war. And there have been slavery and abductions going on of Dinka people from the south into the north. It was certainly discrimination against African people. I would argue, by the way, not simply discrimination by white Moors in the north against black Africans from the south, but rather more complex than that, but certainly discrimination against people of African descent. And then something that I've called, and we're increasingly calling, descent-based slavery. This is traditional forms of slavery in areas of North Africa, West Africa, where people from communities that have historically been called the slave communities, the slave castes, are still held by the way that the world has always worked. Very much nomadic communities, very remote communities often, but there are thousands and thousands of them. We did a study recently in Niger which found very quickly 11,000 people that we actually interviewed, or a partner in Niger called Timidria interviewed, and when asked questions such as who decides whether your children should go to school, the answer was the master. Who decides whether and who your daughter should marry? The master. And there is no doubt that that comes about because of discrimination. An end. That's what I'd like to see, but it's been a bit slow. Three things, I think, are needed. Awareness, understanding, action. Awareness, we're getting better. Lots of discussions about trafficking and lots of links within that to slavery. So people, when I joined the organisation in 1991, if I talked about slavery, only one thing crossed people's minds, and that was history. Whereas today, you get a little bit better than that. But I think it's certainly true that this awareness is not linked with very much understanding of what slavery is about and the realities that it means for life of people. And what we try to do is to put information in the public domain to tell you the realities of what it is. We publish books, we've got a website, you can see all that information there. And then action. Become members. We've got people around here. You can come to the library. You can see what we're doing. We're very anxious to tell you about it. We have campaigns. We want money. All that sort of thing. And I think, just to round it up, there was a debate only 14th of October in the House of Commons on slavery. And Fiona MacTaggart, who was the Home Office Minister responsible, said that raising understanding and awareness of slavery issues and Britain's part in the slave trade, its abolition, and how we can work to eradicate modern-day slavery is the best way in which we can move forward. I can only echo that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David, for that pertinent reminder about our contemporary problems. To wind us up, and before the question and answer session, we have Lincoln Crawford.
Well, I can assure you that I don't know where the drink is, so it's not in my interest to keep you here too long. Anyway, John threw down a challenge, and the question I ask is, are reparations the answer for slavery? As I consider how we rectify the past for the enslavement of Africans, I am conscious of the fact that their suffering took place a long time ago. But the passage of time should not be an excuse for refusing to face up to the fact that transatlantic slavery made fortunes for individuals and laid the basis for wealth for banks and some of the major companies in this society. The slave trade dehumanized millions of Africans, who were cruelly and forcibly removed from their families and from communities. They were then stripped naked and held in leg irons below deck in cramped ships that took them to the Americas. There they were sold into slavery to create wealth for other people. At times, more than 30% would die en route and their bodies would be cast into the water. The most notorious such cases involved the slave ship Zong, whose voyage to the West Indies in 1783 lasted 18 weeks instead of an estimated 6, and ended with 132 slaves being thrown overboard, probably with the intention that their loss should fall upon the underwriters and not on the ship. Less well known, but scarcely less horrifying, was another case 2 years later in 1785, in which 55 slaves died in various ways during the voyage. Although there was some moral outrage from the public, the question which came before Lord Mansfield in the court was not about the morality of it, but was whether the relevant loss fell within the terms of the insurance policy. The ownership of slaves under domestic laws was not illegal, and although most slaves were taken to the colonies, some were sold in Britain. The last slave sold in England was in Liverpool in 1779. However, their status upon arrival was always ambiguous. In 1569, when one Cartwright brought a slave from Russia, whom he proposed to Scrooge, he was questioned, and the court of no less the Star Chamber declared that England was too pure an air for slaves to breathe in. A century later, in 1677, in a case concerning 100 black slaves, the court gave judgment to the plaintiff on the ground that Negroes being usually bought and sold among merchants as merchandise, and also being infidels, there might be a property in them sufficient to maintain trova. Trova is the common law action for the return of personal property being disposed of by another. In 1701, Lord Chief Justice Holt determined that one may be a villain in England, but not a slave, and as soon as a Negro comes to England, he becomes free. However, Mr. Justice Powell, who sat with Holt, thought that the laws of England take no notice of a Negro. When eventually the court was forced to take a decision about the status of slaves in England, in the celebrated case of James Somerset in 1772, the Court of King's Bench took refuge in what would now seem an untenably narrow principle, recognizing the legitimacy of slavery in our overseas dominions, but prohibiting the compulsory return of slaves or former slaves from this country to places where they would be held in bondage. James Somerset, as you know, was born in Africa, was taken as a slave to America. He was bought in Virginia by one Stuart, who later brought Somerset to London. After a period, Somerset absconded. He was recaptured but refused to return to Stuart's service. Stuart had him captured and sent him by force to a ship called the Anne Marie, a vessel commanded by Captain Knowles, there to be held in irons until the vessel sailed to Jamaica, where Somerset was to be sold as a slave. 2 days after the capture, Lord Mansfield issued a writ of habeas corpus directed at Captain Knowles, giving judgment. After the case ended, Lord Mansfield said, "The state of slavery is of such a nature that it is incapable of being introduced on any reason, moral or political, but only positive law, which preserves its force long after the reasons, occasion, and time itself for whence it was created is erased from our memory. It is so odious that nothing can be suffered to support it but positive law. Whatever inconvenience, therefore, may follow from a decision, I cannot say this case is allowed or approved by the law of England, and therefore the black must be discharged." Somerset was freed, and it was not until statute law responded to public opinion in 1833 that the matter was finally settled for this country and her colonies. It's no doubt the treatment of slaves touched unimaginable depths of human depravity. And the only reason the debt toll was not sometimes higher was because slave owners were concerned about making less money from the human cargo. In the Americas, they worked on the sugar, cotton, and tobacco plantations. Some 70% were used on the sugar plantations, where they lived out their lives in servitude. Seems to me there's no doubt the enslavement of Africans was a crime against humanity. A decade after the abolition in 1883, Lord Palmerston in the House of Commons in 1884 said, "If all crimes which the human race has committed from creation down to the present day were added together in one vast aggregate, they will scarcely equal the amount of guilt which has been incurred by mankind in connection with this diabolical slave trade." On the 14th of October, as has already been mentioned, 2004, 160 years after that remark of Lord Palmerston, there was a debate in the House of Commons, which was brought by an early day motion by the Liverpool MP for Riverside, Louis Ellman, which had all party support. And the motion called upon the government to recognize slavery as a crime against humanity. The debate was the debate that followed was led by the Home Office Minister Fiona MacTaggart, who acknowledged slavery was a crime against humanity, and she went on to say slavery and the slave trade were and are appalling tragedies in the history of humanity. The acknowledgement of this awful crime by the government was, it seems to me, long overdue. If we accept, as I do, the validity of four propositions: one, that slavery was a crime against humanity; two, that it was abolished because it was an appalling crime against the African people; three, that the consequences of slavery manifest themselves today in racism against and the disadvantage experienced by people of African descent; and four, that no compensation was ever paid by any of the perpetrators to any of the sufferers. If you accept those four propositions, seems to me, then a case for reparations is made out. Indeed, in summing up the recent debate in the House of Commons, the minister said, "I believe that those who have spoken in this debate share a sense of horror about the history of slavery, a sense of shame that Britain's history and prosperity was built on such a tragedy, such a tragic trade, and a sense of determination to ensure that the abuse of human rights inherent in the slave trade is not repeated. I believe that we also have a shared determination to make appropriate reparations for slavery. It was inevitable that the scale of the injustice created by slavery would present us with a momentous challenge whenever a claim for reparations is made. Such a claim would, by its very nature, be unique and multifaceted. But I believe the cause of reparations is a just one. I will therefore seek to justify my position by suggesting, first of all, Britain's wealth was built on slavery. Secondly, the enslavement of Africans was a crime against humanity. Thirdly, for the majority of slaves, abolition of slavery only partially freed them from servitude. Fourthly, historic injustices can be remedied under human rights remedies. And lastly, there is both a legal and moral case against government for making reparations." Let me say this, John. Let me say, really, and to dispel a common misconception, reparations are commonly interpreted as consisting of only one element, payment of cash. This narrow view is often used by detractors to argue that black people all over the world will be seeking enormous cash handouts from governments once it's conceded that there should be some redress for the crime of slavery. While cash payment is one element, reparations are not about cash payments to individuals. It is my thesis that reparations are about change and consist of a number of different elements, of which compensation is only one. For example, an apology is a form of reparation. An apology was given in the name of the Queen to the Maoris through an act of Parliament in 1995, which she personally signed in New Zealand. In addition to the apology, there was the restoration and compensation for land seized by British settlers in 1863. There was also other compensatory program for the Maoris. Memorials. This is also, it seems to me, another form of reparations. A National Remembrance Day, commemorated annually and not used as a token gesture, is a form of reparation. It is my firm belief that collective memory is a powerful way of reminding people of the sufferings of African people through slavery. Public education, the evil of slavery and the idea it gives that black people are somehow inferior to white people is still with us. Some of the racist behavior we witness in the UK today stems directly from this belief. The history of slavery and the slave trade should become an important part of the school curriculum. Development of Africa. This should also be regarded as an element of reparations. The Prime Minister Commission on Africa is a significant step in dealing with the scar of the continent's underdevelopment, even if he did not put this in the context of reparation. Debt relief. This could also be a form of reparation to those countries which were suffocated by the evil of slavery. In addition to the government, the action the government is taking over Africa, it is my belief that it should take the lead in setting up an international organization based in Britain to deal with reparations for slavery and the slave trade. Its remit could also cover issues arising out of contemporary slavery. So I deal now with the points I have raised. Britain built its wealth from slavery and the slave trade. England became involved in the slave trade in 1562 when, under the reign of Elizabeth I, Captain John Hawkins initiated the trade. Although the English were not pioneers, they became avid participants to an extent that the presence of black people in Britain so alarmed the Queen that she pressed for the blackamoors, as she called them, to be sent out of the country. But the desire to exploit Africa and African people was overwhelming. The next century saw a growing involvement in the trade, with members of the royal family and the government amongst the principal investors. Indeed, in 1660, the Royal Adventurers of Africa were founded in London under the auspices of Prince Rupert with the blessing of King Charles II. The Royal Adventurers of Africa were the first of several companies licensed by the Crown to monopolize the slave trade. The South Sea Company had a contract which it bought from the government following the Treaty of Utrecht in 1713 to import slave and other goods to the Spanish Indies. Its list of shareholders in 1720 included 462 members of the House of Commons, 100 members of the House of Lords, and most of the royal family. A triangular economic cycle then sprang up, which is commonly referred to as the triangular trade, whereby British ships carried guns and currency to Africa to trade for slaves, who were then taken to the Caribbean and the Americas to work on the sugar and cotton plantation. Sugar and cotton were then shipped to Britain, where they were soon, dominated the domestic market. One of the arguments sometimes advanced by conservative historians against the claim for reparation is that it arises only where damage is inflicted by one state upon another during wartime. The counter-argument to that, it seems to me, is that although slavery was generally not conducted in furtherance of war, nor against state that are now in existence, the British Army did use slaves as porters and general assistance in the 7 years of war of 1756 to 63. More than 1,000 of these slaves were sold by the army in Havana at the end of the campaign. So it seems to me that this argument against reparation is not in any view sustainable. The wealth that Britain built from slavery and the slave trade was so gigantic it led Robert Hartley, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, at the time of the signing of the Treaty of Utrecht in 1713, to believe that the new trade generated by the treaty will help to wipe out the national debt. The historian Robin Blackburn put it succinctly when he said, "The use of African slave has enabled Britain to vault to the premier position as an American colonial power." Britain owes Africa and the African people a huge debt, which in my view can only sound in reparations. The enslavement of Africans was a crime against humanity. The Nuremberg Principle gave us some clarification on crimes against humanity, even where they are lawful under domestic law. The Charter of the Nuremberg Tribunal defined crimes against humanity in these words: murder, extermination, enslavement, deportation, and other inhumane acts committed against any civilian population, whether or not in violation of the domestic law or country here perpetrated. It is considered by international lawyers that the Nuremberg Charter did not create new law, but declared and confirmed concepts of international criminality which had been accepted over centuries. As one writer put it, the tribunal found that acts so reprehensible as to offend the conscience of mankind directed against civilian population are crimes in international law. It will not be a task, it seems to me, for historian and their expert to show that the invasion of African territories, the mass capture of Africans, the inhumane conditions under which they were transported, the chattelization of Africans in the Americas, the eradication of the language and culture of Africans constituted violations of international law. The argument such crimes were legal under European law and accepted as normal by most Europeans is not, nor could it be, a defense. Europeans did not then or now constitute all mankind, and the conscience of all decent mankind must always have been outraged by the atrocities which Europeans inflicted on Africans for over 400 years. Indeed, it can be said that it was the ultimate crime against humanity to deny human status to a vast section of humankind. The fact that in some African societies, such as the Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Mauritania, forms of slavery are still practiced cannot be used to exonerate the British and or European slavers. Modern day slavery is a crime against humanity which is to be opposed. But the transatlantic slave trade was a different and uniquely horrific phenomenon, different in its scale, its cruelty, its racist basis, the greed which motivated it, and its consequences for Africans and their descendants globally. Britain was a prime mover in slavery and the slave trade and shall now be a prime mover in reparations for it. Abolition of slavery, however, did not mean the abolition of servitude. A clear prohibition of slavery and the slave trade is to be found in both Article 4 of the European Convention on Human Rights and Article 4 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. What these two documents show is that the right to freedom from slavery was the first human right to be protected by international treaty. Britain's role in this international agreement is demonstrated by its action to abolish slavery and the slave trade. For example, it regulated conduct of the slave trade in 1788, 1790, and 1794, prohibited participation of British ships in the Atlantic slave trade in 1807, made it a felony to be engaged in the slave trade in 1811, gave statutory effect to bilateral treaties providing for the abolition of slave trade in 1818, and it emancipated slaves throughout the Dominion in 1833. Emancipation, however, did not come about solely through the actions of campaigners in England or as a result of the agreement reached between nations. Slaves revolted and put up great resistance, sometimes successfully, the most notable being in the uprising in Santo Domingo, now Haiti, where rebellion led by the slave Toussaint Louverture defeated the French on the 23rd of August 1791 and created the first black state. However, the passing of the 1883 Act did not mean freedom for all. Freedom was only granted to those slaves within the empire who were under the age of six. Those above that age were apprenticed for a further 4 to 6 years to their owners before they could finally receive their freedom. But for even those who were free, life was uncertain. Many of the slaves in England were resettled in Sierra Leone. Those in the Americas eked out a living in very difficult circumstances. As the historian and writer Preston King put it, emancipation was the end of an old game, but was also the old game being played in a new and more complex way, remedying historical injustice. The common law response to slavery and the state of slaves in England was for many years timid, confused, and contradictory. I've been told this before, so I can assure you I'm coming to the end. Now, we face a similar prospect as to how the law would respond to the claim for reparations for slavery. The right to reparation is recognized by international law in the case of Poland. And I should just before I come to conclusion, just say to you that the international law does recognize crime against humanity. It seems to me that the courts in America have responded to claims so far by not actually granting it to the claimants, but saying that it's a political issue, or granting it on very narrow principle. Anyway, we can see that there are claims like that which was a claim has been made by descendants Israel successfully, for example, claimed reparations from West Germany for the cost of resettling Jewish refugees, even though the state of Israel did not exist at the time when the Nazi regime committed its crime against the Jews. So let me come to my conclusion, because I'm forced to. A crime was committed by the British upon the African people. Britain built its wealth on the proceeds of that crime. An implied apology was given to the slave owners for the abolition of slavery and compensated in the sum of £20 million after abolition. No apology was given to the slave, their descendants, or the African people, nor has any compensation ever been paid to them. The minister acknowledged that slavery was a crime against humanity and that appropriate reparation must be made. Not only do I agree with her, it is my firm belief that the only way the past can be rectified is by reparations, and this can only be made by the successor of those who committed the crime and were enriched by it to the successor of the victims who still suffer damage as a result of it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lincoln. I'm sorry to be so rude, but there's an opportunity in the question and answer session maybe to pick up some of the points you needed to run through quickly at the end. I'd like you, in the 20 or so minutes we have left, please to feel free to make comments and or questions. There's a lot of loose ends left about the exact nature of reparations, about whether the contemporary organisation sees a value in historical reparations. A lot of thoughts provoked by the session. There are, I said, looking optimistically, roving microphone at the moment. Two, where there are a few people. Is there any down here? Any roving microphones down here? Very good. Two, excellent. Can I ask you to do a couple of things? If you feel able to, could you please say where you're from, who you are? And could you keep the comment relatively short? Because we do want to get a few comments in before we invite our speakers to respond. I wonder whether anybody wants to kick off, knowing that you're more likely to have my eye caught. I have two already. Gentleman at the back, then the lady here. And then we'll take Claire Moon. If you could give us your name and where you're from and a question or observation, sir.
My name is Ibrahim Pam. I'm from Nigeria. I'm on the MSc Criminal Justice Policy Program. I would like to make two very brief comments. Firstly, the whole question of the morality of the transatlantic slave trade. I mean, I think that's very well established. About how deeply immoral the trade was. But I'm particularly concerned, really, with the economic impact. And I'm glad that Mr. Crawford made this argument in the course of his delivery. The transatlantic slave trade not only engendered economic growth in the countries of the North to which slaves were taken, but conversely, it also retarded or impoverished the countries from which these slaves were taken. There are estimated to have been about 10 million slaves that were taken, essentially off the coast of Africa. These were young and strong, necessarily, the most productive of the societies at the time. And so not only was there the growth engendered in the northern countries, but also a retardation of growth in Africa, and this is really substantial. Mm-hmm. Secondly, and without stretching the argument or making it too tenuous, there is the claim also that the formal end of the transatlantic slave trade was followed by a more insidious form of slavery or bondage, which is the argument on colonialism and neocolonialism. So where the transatlantic slave trade boosted the agricultural revolution in the West and in northern countries, the systems that followed, which is neocolonialism and former colonialism, promoted the exploitation of mineral resources from Africa, which to a large extent supported the industrial revolution in Europe and the Americas. So you're looking at two different forms of the same sort of exploitation that have that one succeeded the other. which, you know, eventually promoted these distortions. So I think the claim for reparations and reparation, in the words of Dr. Topi, are valid on arguments about economics and not necessarily only morality.
Right, thank you. I'll take it as an observation, and they may or may not want to comment, but that's very helpful. The lady directly in front and a bit to your right. Madam.
Hello, my name is Professor Marcy Simpson, and I'm a professor of forensic regeneration and race. And I'm more interested in your views in terms of reparations, or I would rather describe it as damages, for the living survivors of descendants of slaves, and the consequences of slavery. And I'm being very specific in terms of the African Caribbean communities in particular. I'm also interested in the point made about the particular minister and her comments in Parliament, because my dealings with central government, and that includes the very senior civil servants, it is clear to me that they have a very difficult notion of slavery, of discrimination. So I hear what you say as academics, as intellectuals, but there's a disconnection between what you say and what I say, for instance, and what happens in terms of central government and even advisors to central governments. I'd like your views, please.
Was that aimed at Lincoln particularly? Was that aimed at Lincoln in particular, or everybody? Thank you. Claire. And then we'll take this gentleman up.
I'm Claire Moon from Department of Sociology, Centre for the Study of Human Rights. I've got two points to put to John Torpy. Firstly, I'd like you to say something about, this is an issue you've written about, the resistance to slavery reparations in the US, not by whites, but by African Americans, who object to liberal bourgeois gestures like making apologies, memorial practices, and so on. So if you could say something about that. And I also want to push you a little bit on the issue of genocide and the retrospective application of the term, and you mentioned the case of Armenia. And I take the point that the primary function of that kind of labelling should be about prevention of future genocide. But there is a reparatory function in that retrospective naming of a massacre as genocide. And it's about endowing it with a different moral narrative of the past, which is also about prevention of repetition in the future. So it does have that instrumental function. It's not merely about fetishizing the past and dwelling on the past. So I wonder if I just want to push you a little bit on that point.
Great, thank you. I think we'll ask John to deal with that directly, and then come to Lincoln on the other, and then perhaps David, or we might go back to the audience then. John.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for all these questions, and not sure really where to start, but I mean, I may have thrown down a challenge, as Lincoln said, but I'm not sure it's the one that he thinks it was. That is to say, I think he and I agree that slavery was, you know, morally repugnant, and it was a crime against humanity, as has now been affirmed by the UN Conference on Racism. And from my perspective, that's not the issue. I mean, that, to me, in a certain sense, goes without saying. The question is, how do we make amends for that? And, I mean, one of the things that I was trying to convey with this kind of discussion, the difference between the notion of reparation and reparations, is that the word has many meanings. And, I mean, there's a certain way in which I think in the U.S., which perhaps is the case I know best, there is this tendency, because I think of the kind of model character of Holocaust-related reparations or compensation, there is this tendency to see this notion in terms of individual checks. And as I say, I think that tends to provoke a lot of negative reaction. So my concern is, you know, how do we achieve the kinds of making amends for the inequalities that I think unarguably derive from slavery, but also from segregation in the United States and from the slave trade in general elsewhere, and what's effective politically. And so, I mean, part of the reason that the current upsurge of talk about reparations for blacks in the United States has taken place is because there was a sense that affirmative action was politically back on its heels and faced, indeed, as probably most of you know, a very serious challenge that went to the Supreme Court and that sort of thing. But in any case, the issue, it seems to me, is you know, what will be politically effective, what will be successful, and I sometimes worry that framing the problem. Just as I mean, the reason I mentioned the Japanese American case and the fact that they used the term redress rather than reparations, they also called the bill that was passed in Congress that appropriated or mandated really the compensation of $20,000 for each person who had been, you know, wrongfully incarcerated during World War II. They called that law the Civil Liberties Act of 1988. Precisely to avoid and calling any attention to the group in question. And I think both of those things were aspects of the success of that movement. It's also true that, you know, that movement was more successful because there were only 120,000 people who had to be compensated, whereas when we're talking about the black population of the United States, we're talking about something on the order of 13% of the total population. And indeed, that redress settlement, that Civil Liberties Act of 1988, was framed in many ways specifically in terms that were designed to try to forestall the possibility that blacks would use it as a precedent. That was, I would say, quite unsuccessful, as it turns out. There are further problems with regard to Africa. Some of you may know that, well, there was an organization here, as far as I know, now defunct, called the African Reparations Movement, associated with Bernie Grant. And that, in some ways, got its start at a conference in Abuja, in Nigeria, in 1992, I believe it was, where the OAU convened a conference designed to pursue the notion of reparations for Africa. And one part of the problem, as Wole Soyinka reports in the paper from which, or the article from which I quoted earlier, is that there was a division among the attendees. We're talking about the African continent. Well, the problem was that, you know, some people wanted it to be about slavery, but that was somewhat embarrassing for particularly, you know, Muslim countries from the north who had been, you know, very much involved in the slave trade. And so there was a division over whether or not the compensation was to be for slavery or for colonialism. But as Soyinka points out, this leads in very, very different directions, and I think in the end led to the demise of this whole effort because it simply couldn't be approached sort of coherently. I think you're right that in many of these, I mean, in the Armenian case that I mentioned, it's not about the money. But in the case that you're talking about, it is about the money, right? And it really depends. I mean, sometimes it's really about acknowledgement. I mean, some Armenians, anyway, say, you know, we're not interested in anything else. We just want the Turks to admit that, you know, I mean, I think, again, this kind of preoccupation with the term genocide is in some ways overdone. Everybody agrees that terrible things happened and they were at the hands of the Turkish Ottoman regime. But in any case, I think in the case of Africans generally, in the case of African Americans, black Americans, you know, economics is more important than other issues. I mean, there are other kinds of reparation that could be made, but it really is centrally about righting economic inequalities that are said to stem, and I mean, I believe, but it is part of the argument that, or you have to make the argument that these inequalities stem from slavery and or from segregation, Jim Crow. And this gets into, well, the question about opposition from among some blacks in the U.S. to this notion. I mean, I think the case that you may be thinking of that I wrote about in that article, really, the only prominent black left-wing progressive intellectual I know of
who opposes this is a guy named Adolf Reed, who writes a column for the progressive magazine called The Progressive. And he sort of articulated his opposition to this partially because he thinks it's politically not, that it will never command anything like the kind of majority that it would need in order to actually, you know, see the light of day through Congress, but also because he is quite critical of the kind of therapeutic side of this and the tendency, and I think this may go to one of the questions in the back, the kind of tendency of those whom he sees in the kind of leadership of the reparations movement, of the tendency of those people to see other blacks as somehow damaged by racism. And in other words, he objects to this kind of perception, which, you know, I think is in some ways more widespread now, to see people as, you know, fundamentally as weak and not as resilient, unable to overcome trauma, which is now, 125 years ago, the word trauma was purely a physical kind of characterization. Now it's clearly mental. We tend to think that people don't overcome these traumas and that sort of thing. And I think that's his kind of sensibility, that, first of all, it's politically not viable. Although other things may be. I mean, you know, going after Scott, it's really about economic empowerment, whether you call it reparations or not, is to me, a strategic or a tactical question. So, and the reparatory function of retrospective naming, sure, I don't disagree with that. I think if Turkish society, entry into the EU is going to put a lot of pressure on Turkey to address this issue. And, I mean, it's not just a matter of, you know, will they say something about this? Will they admit or kind of plead that it was genocide? But rather, this is a fundamental kind of blockage in the Turkish national psyche, so to speak. I don't like to speak kind of in terms of collective psychology, but in any case, there is this general kind of refusal to allow discussion. Indeed, it's largely criminalized. So if you think about the difference between Germany, where it's illegal to deny the Holocaust, and Turkey, where it's illegal to say that, you know, there was a genocide in 1915, you have a sense of the problem.
That's great, John. I'm going to take a couple more before I go to our other guests, because we're up against the clock now, but I'm delighted we are. But we have the lady at the back here, and we have an alumni. I always favor alumni at the MSC, so we're going to come to you in a minute. But we're just taking this gentleman. Actually, we're taking this gentleman. He had his hand up earlier, and then we'll take you. And is there anybody on the top who wants to speak? Because we do have a very equal opportunities policy. We've worked on it over many months. No? Okay. Where you go?
Thank you. My question is for Dr. Turkey.
And you are? Just because I know who you are doesn't mean everybody else does?
I'm Rhonda Day from SAS, formerly with the Human Rights Program.
Okay.
Still coming because...
okay, we don't need to know any of that. Just carry on. We're running out of time. We don't need your personal history.
My question for Dr. Toby, when we talk in general about reparation, not specifically on the slavery case, I think there might be a tension between the issue of symbolic reparation, monuments, museums, apologies, and the legislation or human rightization of this claim. Mm-hmm. And because I think apologies, museum, monuments have been around for quite a while. What is new is the attempt to elevate these demands into international human rights norms. And you mentioned the Bastioni Report and the Van Boren Principle, which are currently sort of international soft law, but they might be on the way to be something a bit stronger. And I think usually we think it's a good idea if social demands that we think are positive are becoming international human rights norms. Mm-hmm. But it might, I suggest, be counterproductive to legislate apologies, to legislate museums. I mean, the usefulness of apologies is only if it is perceived as sincere. If it's a legal duty, then it might not be perceived as sincere. And the same thing, I mean, for example, it's a very good thing that in Vancouver you have this museum for the culture of indigenous people. But let's assume that theoretically the white community in Vancouver was opposing this. And it was only established because Ottawa forced it, or even worse, some human rights committee in Geneva has forced it to become there. And then again, where do you stop? Can you force people to come to the museum? Can you force them to enjoy it? And so So I was wondering what your perspective is. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. We take the one at the back. Is there anybody else really desperate to ask a question? Because we're running right up against time. Madam.
I am Simone Milani, and I'm an A-level student. I just wanted to make the point about, apart from the fact of economic reparations and, you know, addressing the human rights issue as well, I think it's important to look at the social implications that slavery had. I think that, I mean, it's all well and good for, like, you know, liberals to come along and say, oh, yeah, we'll, you know, talk about reconciliation and things, but I think slavery has actually had more of an impact on the sort of self-conscious of black African communities and stuff, and the way they can work in sort of like a Western social system. And it's often, it's interesting to see that black people who rise, like, you know, to the top of their profession and stuff, often have to adopt the norms of that society and find it difficult to kind of bring in their own culture and their own ideas about things. I think, like, often just sort of being aware of your own culture hasn't really been highlighted very much, and I think, you know, often that's been forgotten, and sort of integrate into that culture you have to take on all their values, and sort of values of black African cultures have sort of been demoted a bit as a result of slavery, and I think that's quite important.
Thanks very much. I'll take that as a comment at all three, but you were certainly looking at John, so we say sort of you have to think about that one as well. But I think I'm now going to ask Lincoln and David. There were some earlier questions. And David, when we come to we take Lincoln perhaps first, thing, but recognizing,
Can I say, the gentleman at the back there who talk about the economic effect that slavery had on Africa, I underscore what you say and I agree. More specifically, I would want to deal with the ladies and the lady point there about the disconnection between what it seems the minister is saying in her debate comments and what civil servants do. There was a disconnection. There probably still is, but I think it is a little bit blurred. And I say that because in 2001, when there was the World Conference against Slavery in South Africa, I went as a part of the government delegation there to that conference. And it was a very interesting thing to attend. But when you, with the government delegation, you go to, you know, toe the line. But I can tell you that from the British point of view and the European point of view, at that time, there was an argument as to whether slavery was a crime against humanity. I mean, could you imagine where we were in 2001? Now, that, I think, is accepted by the minister. And not only that, they were worried then that any form of apology, any sort of a concession that it was a crime against humanity would come with an invoice. And it does slightly irritate me, because, I mean, we have allowed ourselves to get detracted by those who build upon this notion that reparations is all about money, it's all about the cash, and it's not. I think the question of slavery, as the lady mentioned over there, it is far more significant than that. And recently, when I was watching the Remembrance Day, I mean, I was really moved by the way we remember the dead. And I think collective memory is so important, and therefore to have a National Remembrance Day, not as a token gesture, as a one-off, but on a sort of a annual basis, is one way to bring about the collective memory as to what happened for slavery, because it was a crime. It is admitted now that it's a crime. And in international law, as I hope I outline, recognize it is a crime, and it says that where there is a crime against humanity, there ought to be reparations. I think we descend into the situation where everybody thinks that the blacks all over the world are going to be crawling out of the woodwork, lining up on every street corner, expecting to get a check made out in their own personal name for it. And that's not what it's about. But it's a very difficult, it's a difficult claim to bring. I mean, I'll concede that. I mean, I hope the claim in America succeeds. But it's got some very difficult issues. I mean, the lawyers over there, first of all, we have now the people who bring the claim in America. There's a direct connection, because at the time when it was raised in the past, there wasn't the DNA evidence that connects certain people with slavery, whereas we got that now. There's also the argument that once you concede that something is a crime against humanity, the question of limitation really goes out of the window, and I think that's a point which we have here, the limitation point in this country, is going to cause us some difficulty. But to put it more succinctly, my position is that reparations is the only way to rectify the past, and I think it's right that the government acknowledge that it's a crime against humanity and that we should do something about it. The action which which we talk about is where we should start. Some organization here that look at the forms of reparations we can offer, how we manage it. But I think it's not difficult enough to start with something which could be touching and which could bring about collective memory. So I think it is not, as the gentleman was saying, the museum and other things has been around for a long time. I really think collective memory is important, and if we have an annual day remembering slavery, it will, in the consciousness of people, tell and educate you what it was all about.
Thanks, sir. And David, does your organization have a view on reparations and reparation?
Yeah, I mean, generally we're in favor. Before the 2001 World Conference Against Racism, we and other NGOs did get together and came up with a series of recommendations for reparations, which in fact, probably listening to Lincoln, I couldn't differentiate between exactly what he said. But as a sidelight on that, and Lincoln may be able to comment better as he was there, but our understanding in terms of political realities of the 2001 World Conference Against Racism is that there was what you might call a devil's pact between European governments and some South Asian governments that they would not push too hard for recognition of slave trade as a crime against humanity, and the European governments would not push too hard for the issue of caste discrimination to be looked upon during the World Conference Against Racism. Now, I can't prove that, but I would suggest quite strongly that it was one of the reasons why the conference, although debates were quite good, never actually came up with particularly good wordings around either of these issues. And just as one sidelight on the question at the end about social issues, because I do feel that this question of identity is important, and it's important also in terms of contemporary slavery, and particularly with questions of children trafficked away from home when they're young. What is taken away from many of those, if you meet them, is their identity, is that understanding of the communities they've come from, their parents, or the society that they live with. And that, in lots of ways, was what was taken away from most of the Africans who were trafficked in the slave trade to the Americas. Their identity was taken away from them.
Thank you. And very briefly, before I conclude the occasion, John.
Okay, thank you. Ron, in response to your, of course, I mean, you can't legislate apologies where it takes all the sincerity out of its sails, so to speak. So, I mean, that I don't think is really intended by the Bassiouni principles. It's rather things like compensation of some sort, getting your name cleared if you've been arrested wrongly and that sort of thing. So I don't think it mandates, you know, an apology in that sense. And as you say, I mean, there are all kinds of problems with public apologies, apologies from a person who, you know, wasn't alive or participating in the wrong and to which collectivity, et cetera. So there are all kinds of problems with that. Apropos your comment in the back, I think I would just say that people, I mean, in my view, people have to be free to be whatever they are, whatever that happens to be, and whether it involves, you know, some kind of loyalty to what they think of as their culture, which I think is itself a problematic construction, or not. And I would leave it at that. I mean, I think people have to be free to be whoever they are, however they think about what that is. That should mean, in other words, that they're not forced to adopt some other set of ways. And finally, just one comment quickly on the UN Conference on Racism. In the immediate sort of run-up to that, Human Rights Watch, and apparently I'm told it was penned by Kenneth Roth, the director, put out a proposal about sort of exploring the idea of reparations. And in particular, basically what they proposed, I have to stop popping my peas, is to create essentially the equivalent of truth commissions to explore the extent to which in Brazil, South Africa, and the United States,
inequality, racial inequality is rooted in prior experiences of slavery or apartheid, and to what extent it's a function of more, you know, of subsequent inequalities and structures and that sort of thing. And I thought it was actually one of the most creative and interesting interventions in this whole discussion. But and I called Kenneth Roth and said I was working on this and I would be very interested in working on it with him. He said, why don't you write up your thoughts on this campaign? I did that on September 10th. I sent them to him the next morning, unaware of what had happened in New York, and they completely dropped the issue after 9/11 because they've had their hands full with other things. But it was a very interesting. The document can be found on the Human Rights Watch website.
Yeah, of course, we work closely with Human Rights Watch. So a few things to say. One is we have a big event on the 9th of December, the day before Human Rights Day. We have Anne Orrs, who's the Chief Inspector of Prisons, coming here. So you're all very welcome to that at 6 o'clock, I think, in this room on the 9th of December. The other thing to say is the drinks are, and you're all extremely welcome to the drinks, and all of our guests are coming to the drinks, and they'll be there, and maybe there were some issues you wanted to take up with them. You can do it with them, and they're on the fifth floor of this building in the senior dining room. So if you're not a member of the senior team at the LSE, you can pretend you are. You can walk through proprietorially and drink the drink. So we'd like to see you all up there. There's lifts outside, fifth floor, and follow the signs to the senior dining room. And finally, can we all join in thanking our three guests for what was cumulatively a fantastic exposition of a very complex field and for going to the trouble of taking such care over their presentations. So since we don't pay them large appearance fees, can we give them a round of applause?